Welcome to episode 9 of the Global Guessing Weekly Podcast. This is a very different one. We're joined again by a good friend of Global Guessing, Ross, and he's actually streaming live right now on TikTok. We are currently working on a forecast regarding war in the Donbass on Metaculus, and there's a question that asks, if there's going to be war in the region in the next year or by the end of the year, and that's defined as 250 or more deaths of Ukrainian militants in any given month. And so because of Ross's expertise with war and war studies and geopolitics in general, we thought it'd be great to have a conversation with him. And he was kind enough to, show this to his audience, and hopefully we can have a really nice, fruitful discussion just about what's going on in the region and where everything is headed.
Cool. Good to be on. Good to see you.
So, Ross, why don't you sort of start off and give us sort of an overview on sort of the news this week on Donbass? I know you made a video on TikTok and on your YouTube channel talking about it. So sort of what's going on?
So where do I start? I mean, obviously, I spoke to you guys before we just came on, and I've been sort of keeping tabs on Ukraine and the East, and from what I've seen, Ukraine was starting to maybe build troops up. I can't necessarily confirm it. A lot of these things you can't really quantify necessarily or confirm, but I think I saw a lot of videos of Ukraine building up forces, and then over the past couple of weeks, maybe 2.5 weeks, Russia has started to build up their own troops. Then yesterday, quite a few things happened. I'll try to go back. So yeah, a couple of weeks, Russia, I think they moved 80,000 troops into the sort of vicinity of the Ukrainian border. I don't know how close they were. I saw someone say 500 kilometers. I've seen others say, well, pretty close. Then yesterday, Russia announced that they were going to close the Kerch Strait. I can't remember if that was confirmed or not, but I saw that as a sort of rumor. I think it's from Interfax, which is a website in Ukraine that does news. I think they said Russia will close the Kerch Strait between Crimea and sort of mainland Russia, which would mean that Mariupol and another port would be cut off from the Black Sea, which was quite a big thing. And then I think the Russia expelled some US diplomats yesterday as well in tit for tat, they said. And I think the US obviously imposed sanctions the day before as well. So yep. It's kind of, I went on a live yesterday or the day before, and I said, I don't think there's going to be a war over it, but I don't know. I mean, the chance has gone up a little tiny bit, I'd say, but I don't think there's going to be a state-on-state conflict. As I say, I think it'll be asymmetric. So it'll be between the different proxy groups there. So obviously the separatists and the Ukrainian military, and whether NATO sends advisors in or whatever happens there, I'm not entirely sure. I mean, it's quite open at the moment, I think, personally, what could happen. But yeah, I'm just trying to think in regards to Russia. I don't exactly know. I mean, no one knows what Russia's going to do, but yeah, I'll leave it at that. It's pretty long-winded, open explanation, as usual, so.
Yeah. I think your high level take is spot on. Clay and I, we have a connection, a guy named Aaron Schwartzbaum, who used to work at the Eurasia Group and now works at a company called Permis Data. And we were talking to him about what's going on in Russia. He speaks Russian, he has a newsletter all about Russian affairs. And what he was saying, and I thought it was really interesting, was that, Russia, as we know, has been sort of building up their military presence on the border with Ukraine, but they've made that very public. And so if they were really trying to go to war, really trying to start something, they'd probably be more covert about their operations. But because they've been so public, because, the media has picked up on exactly what they're doing, has numbers, as you said, as to how many troops are being moved, he sees it as more of a move of deterrence. You have to act proportionately when Ukraine is building up troops on the border as well. But that Russia is not looking to get into any war right now, which I think, as you said, is pretty accurate.
How does that sort of compare to the troop buildup before back with the Russo-Ukrainian conflict back in 14? 14? Yeah. Like how does that compare? I'll admit I'm just ignorant in terms of how the beginning of that conflict played out. Do any of you guys know?
My guess is that the main differences between 2014 and now would be less so the buildup and more so just where the two countries are and like the state of the world and like how that might affect, you know, countries' intentions. I think in 2014, Russia was just in a much different place. I think, you know, it made sense for them to be a bit more aggressive, and, you know, they actually ended up annexing Crimea, right, and taking control of Crimea over from Ukraine. I think now, you know, given the pandemic, you know, when is Russia's next election coming up? Do you know? I think it's...
Is it 2022 or 2021?
I believe it's 2022 or 3.
I think it's 2022.
Yeah.
But yeah, like if you look at Putin's approval ratings in Russia, right, he's doing fine. Like there isn't any real impetus for aggression. Whereas if you look at Ukraine, you know, Zelensky's approval ratings have been going down over the past year or two. And so I think there's probably more incentive on his part to try and make a show of force than for Russia to actually engage on a serious level.
But I mean, actually, his approval rating is just about as low as it was in late 2013 before he did the action in Ukraine. Back in 2013, it bottomed out around 64%. And as of right now, Putin's at anywhere between 60 and 65%. And so actually, in many ways, it is sort of similar in which Putin might be inclined to do military action as a way to, you know, boost his domestic approval rating. Last time, you know, all the caveats necessary for Russian polling, but, you know, it jumped up 20 points. That's quite significant. Putin now in the slump trying to come out of coronavirus, it actually might be the reason why he would try to actually do military action right now, or, you know, sub-threshold conflict, most likely.
It does play well, doesn't it? I think Putin's approval rating, I'm trying to link this to the protests that happened a few months ago with Navalny and stuff like that. I mean, Navalny's not popular at all, really. I don't think a lot of Russians have even heard of him before this year. But obviously, that's creeping up on him, or maybe that's in the back of the Russian sort of government mind. I don't know. I can't sort of confirm that, but maybe that has something to do with the approval necessarily. I'm trying to think about how to articulate that, but yeah. Maybe on the Russian political scene, that is sort of in the back of the mind of the government. But I'm not entirely sure how that would relate to what's going on in Ukraine at the moment. But yeah, I did have another point as well. I can't remember now. But yeah.
Yeah. So Ross, you brought up before the sanctions that Biden put on Russia. I was reading, I think it was a New York Times article, and I was looking at the quotes from Biden and his disposition towards his sanctions on Russia is very similar to what he said about the airstrikes that he did in Syria, you know, a few months ago, which was that he was trying to be like proportionate and that he wasn't trying to go to war with Russia right now, that he was trying to have a measured response to their election hacks and such. And so I think it'll be interesting to see what the US does. As you said, there's been this tit for tat now back and forth. I'm curious as to how that might escalate things, if at all.
Yeah, well the US was sending two warships to the Black Sea. I don't know if you saw that, but they got turned around yesterday, didn't they? So obviously maybe you thought that was a bad idea, sailing those into Russia's sort of backyard, so to speak.
Very intense. And I think it's probably tricky for Russia as well, because I don't think that they want to go to war. Like, Ukraine has a lot of utility for them, right? They're sort of that transit country in between Russia and like going more into Western Europe. And, you know, if you're trying to transport oil or natural gas, you sort of need that pathway. And so I don't think they'd want to see, you know, the integrity of those pipelines and those communities, you know, torn asunder by war. So I feel like, you know, the threshold, you know, at which Putin is going to turn to sort of outright violence might be a bit higher, you know, but I mean, it's definitely still possible, you know, if Ukraine is serious about forcing their hand.
I saw somewhere, I think it was very, very unconfirmed, but I thought someone talked about Ukraine getting nuclear weapons again. which was interesting.
They had Russia's nukes.
Yeah, they gave them up, didn't they?
Well, because they couldn't use them
in exchange for autonomy.
Well, yeah. and they couldn't use them.
Deals. Yeah,
they didn't have the code, so they just had nuclear weapons.
They could have dismantled them.
I think quite a lot of nuclear weapons from the Soviet Union actually went missing. I think it was like 16 warheads are unaccounted for or something.
That's the funny thing about nuke math is that, you know, you talk about regulation, but if you don't even know the starting point of how many there are, then it's tough to say that you built more, you know, because it's like there's such little transparency.
Yeah.
Do any of you think that this is like a, this might be like a wild theory, but like Ukraine, you know, building up arms because they know Russia's going to respond this way and trying to bait NATO into this conflict again, like they got into it in 2014. Because I know, like, you know, obviously Ukraine's been trying to join NATO. We talked about how maybe NATO's not as eager to have them join, you know, but this got the U.S. to, you know, at least temporarily send ships to the Black Sea, you know, and get the rest of the international community involved. Could that be sort of the bigger picture here? Because obviously they're not going to win in an outright conflict with Russia. Like, what do you think the goals here for Ukraine are?
From Russia, sorry, or from the U.S.?
Well, from Ukraine, I think. Like, what do you think that they, like, what's the ideal outcome for them in this whole situation?
I think Ukraine wants economic development. I think that's the end goal. And obviously, they need, for that to happen, they need to ensure security. So they want to join NATO. They've got the security there. And that obviously would mean they'd probably join the EU. I think EU membership is the core of this for Ukraine. I think in 2014, part of the reason why they had that Euromaidan revolution was because they wanted to get closer to the EU. I think Russia sort of leaned on, I can't remember his name now, it's terrible. But yeah, the sort of president before Russia very, very much leaned on him to not move towards the EU. And then obviously the backlash from that was the Euromaidan revolution. And now Russia's got this separatist conflict going on in the East. It's a frozen conflict. You look at other frozen conflicts in the post-Soviet space. You've got Georgia, Nagorno-Karabakh. There's a few in Central Asia, Transnistria and Moldova. There's Russian peacekeepers in Moldova and in Georgia. And those are two countries that would either want to, Moldova probably wants to join the EU for economic development reasons. Same as Georgia, they probably want to join the EU and NATO. But because they have those separatist conflicts, they can't join. I think that's very much the case in Ukraine, is that if Russia keeps the conflict frozen and Ukraine doesn't have its territorial integrity, it can't join the EU or NATO. I think that's very much at the core of why Russia is doing what it's doing. But that
makes a lot of sense.
That also comes back to Russia's the whole thing for this is Russia's main geographic problem, which is that it's got the Northern European plain that's been attacked through three times throughout history. You had Napoleonic Wars, where Napoleon swept on over through Poland and Germany and sort of Belarus and took Moscow. And then obviously the Germans came through in the First World War through that exact same route. And then the Germans came back again in the Second World War and attacked Russia, and they lost 27 million. The USSR lost 27 million people. And obviously those conflicts play into the Russian mindset of we need security. Or even going back to sort of the sort of Muscovite history of the Principality of Muscovy. Muscovy was sort of medieval predecessor to Russia. The whole reason the Russian Empire got to the size it was is because they just wanted land to buffer that core. Obviously, you can even trace it back to the Mongolian Empire. Russia was part of the Mongolian Empire. So they've just been steamrolled by so many countries that they want that buffer zone, and Ukraine comes into that. Obviously, like I say, Georgia can't join NATO. Armenia, Azerbaijan can't join NATO because they have a frozen conflict. Ukraine can't join now because they have a frozen conflict. Belarus can't join because obviously Lukashenko is close to Russia as well. And then the Baltic countries, I think they sort of slipped in at the right moment. They were small enough, dynamic enough at the time, and they were able to join the EU and NATO, which was kind of not, I wouldn't, maybe lucky is not the right word, but it was kind of the right time, the right place. I think otherwise Russia would probably look at, if they weren't in, if they were in the same place as the other post-Soviet countries, they probably wouldn't be in the EU or NATO right now. They'd probably have their own frozen conflicts as well, maybe. I don't know. But yeah, that's my sort of analysis of, historical analysis of Russia. I think that's what the root is of this. So,
and I don't want to keep you talking too much, but do you think, I mean, when you came on our podcast the first time, we talked a lot about hybrid warfare.
Yeah.
Right now it seems to be fairly traditional tanks, you know, vehicles, troops. Do you see the potential for hybrid warfare to crop up in this conflict?
Well, sorry, Russia has in Ukraine. Like
between Russia and Ukraine. Yeah, we've seen Russia obviously is very comfortable in cyberspace.
Yeah.
Might they try something like that, you know, this time around?
Well, they I think they did in either 2014 or 15, so it wouldn't shock me this time. They shut down a few Ukrainian electricity grid, part of it got taken down by hacks. So, and then obviously the political aspect of hybrid warfare. You've got disinformation campaigns, all those sort of things to play into it. So yeah, I think we could see escalation on those fronts. I think my first ever video on my YouTube channel was about, well, the first clip was General James Mattis of the US, and he said,
Mad Dog Mattis.
Yeah, he said that where we are weak, our enemies will attack us because they know they don't have the kinetic power to take us on in the sort of military field. So they'll turn to other avenues of attack, which is very true. And he said, if hybrid warfare isn't the future, I think he said, I'll buy you a beer or something. he doesn't owe anyone a beer at the moment, I don't think, because it is becoming the future. So
I would have a feeling that, like, if this is going to escalate this conflict, that almost certainly you would see hybrid warfare being involved, right? Like, especially on social media, like that might even be like the precursor, if depending on if there's like an increase in social media, particularly on the border of the conflict, then you could probably expect things to continue to escalate as sort of like it's one of the strengths of the Russian military, and it's a good way to set the ground for if they're able to take territory, then to keep it afterwards. And so I would imagine that if this is going to escalate into conflict, that the hybrid aspects would come in before it even started. Because that happened in 2014. And I don't, has there been any sort of news in terms of what Russia is doing sort of, and I know it's all talking about the troop buildup, but has there been any articles or reports on other?
Not that I've seen personally. I don't know if you've seen any, Andrew, or...
No, but maybe that speaks to this idea that Russia's not looking to get into war, at least at the moment, because if they were, maybe they would have started engaging in hybrid warfare as opposed to this very, you know, sort of out in the open military buildup.
Or they are and no one's reporting on it, and they want to focus on military troop buildup numbers because that makes for a better media headline.
Oh, fear sells, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So you're saying that there might be, you think Russia might have already employed some...
I mean, it's so cheap to do. Like, I don't... Yeah, I mean, like, if it's probably cheaper to do that than walking troops up to the border, and just logistically that cost. So I think you would almost have to do it if you're being somewhat sort of cost-effective in terms of your strategy. Even if they're not going to do it, I would imagine on a small scale, they've already started it.
Yeah,
you would think that Ukraine would be talking about it at least, right? If that was going on.
Yeah,
or maybe they are, but we just can't read Ukrainian newspapers. No.
You can look at the Kiev Post, which is very much a Ukrainian orientated website. Kiev Post, I think it's called. That's sort of the Ukrainian line on everything. So that's quite interesting.
Yeah, it's very useful, actually.
Someone in the comment section says, is Putin being bolder because he sees the U.S. administration under Biden as weaker? So
I'll let you guys answer that one.
I mean, I think that's one way of viewing it, but I think very often we view Russian actions in context of the U.S. first, when I think the U.S. should definitely, that's not the first thing that Putin is responding to every single day. And all of his actions are viewed through the lens of the United States administration at the time. Now, is it a coincidence that this happens when the Biden administration is coming in? You know, right? This could be a way to test how close the U.S. and the EU can cooperate, especially on issues of Russia, where a country like Germany is a little less aggressive than I think many people who are against Russia would claim. So I'm not sure that, you know, this viewing this through a change in the U.S. administration is necessarily the right way versus viewing it from what's happening with regards to Russia first. Andrew?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think, like you said, Putin, Russia have priorities outside of, you know, being the enemy of the U.S. You know, namely, as we were talking about, Ukraine has very high geopolitical significance in terms of helping Russia transport and export, you know, oil and liquefied natural gas from Russia into other parts of Europe. And so I think making sure that those pipelines and those pathways are secured is like probably more important than testing Biden. And I think Biden's already been tested once or twice already in his presidency, and we've seen sort of what sort of response we're going to get. He's not, you know, a warmonger. He's not Trump. He's going to try and be as moderate, as proportionate as possible, unless, I guess, you know, he's forced to otherwise. So, I think Putin has some other priorities right now. But it might have affected timing, like Clay said.
I mean, but was Trump a warmonger, though, either? He didn't
at
get into
in words.
Well, in words, but, you know, that's like the one thing that doesn't matter in geopolitics, really, is words. I mean, maybe for history books later, so then historians can piece together a narrative, but it's action. And I mean, I think neither of them are particularly interventionist in comparison to previous modern U.S. presidents. I know.
I think that might also just be a product of less interventionism in general around the world. You know, I feel like you just see less of it these days than you did back in like the Kissinger era.
It's less politically viable, isn't it?
There's less intervention now than the Kissinger era. That's what you're saying.
For some reason,
I interpreted that the wrong way around, and I was about to be very confused.
I think comparing Trump and Biden. I mean, Trump struck Syria, did he not? He's only had one term, hasn't he? But yeah, He also fired missiles into Syria. I think he hit an empty runway at a university or something, chemical weapons.
We killed a few jihadists under his reign as well.
He very much privatized the drone strikes, didn't he? I think he started rolling out the privatizing the drone.
Drones. Obama liked drones too, to be fair.
Yeah. Though. So I think, I can't remember if he involved the CIA in some way in the US drone program, or if he allowed the CIA itself to carry out drone strikes. I remember that being quite controversial. So it's interesting.
Will Ukraine and Russia go to war? I mean, I don't think I would say the odds of war are exceedingly low. It's just, I don't think war is necessarily in vogue right now. And I don't think that, you know, war would increase the cost for what Putin wants far too much. And if it didn't go that way, that would almost ensure that Ukraine would then fall into NATO. And then, you know, Putin has lost his objective of trying to keep that buffer state between NATO and Russia. Now, whether or not there will be fighting conflict and people will die who are part of the Ukrainian and Russian armies, I think that's a very sort of different question. Well, what the magnitude of that is, what the casualty number will be, what the likelihood is, I think is up for debate. And I think I'd be interested to hear what you guys have to take on that as well. But I would say war, highly unlikely, like say 5, maybe 10% chance max. But fighting and skirmishes between the border and troops, I think, is higher than that.
The way I'd put it is you have to think of a bell curve of influence, like have sort of war at one end and no war at the other, and in between, where it's the highest, is where the highest leverage is, if you get what I mean. If you were to look at a curve that went sort of like that, I'm trying to do it on the screen, but yeah, if you get what I mean, like a sort of curve like that, you want to be at the top, don't you, where you have maximum influence. And obviously that point lies between outright hostility and just doing nothing, I guess. I don't explain that very well, but yeah, he wants to maximize his leverage. And obviously you don't want to overdo it, overcook it and go into war, because it's not very good for leverage, is it? That's just, you're minimizing your leverage. I think Andrew's nodding. He's probably got something to add there, but yeah, that's the way I kind of view it.
Yeah, no, just totally agree. You know, Clay and I are both forecasters, and so something that we think about a lot are base rates. And in 2020, there were some skirmishes in the Himalayas between the Chinese and India. And those are two, you know, countries that have a similar history of conflict and tension. And they're even more sort of equally matched than Ukraine and Russia. And that didn't escalate into full out war. And those casualties were in a similar sort of volume to what we're seeing at the Ukrainian border currently, where I think there have been sort of, you know, one-off killings here, there, you know, I think I saw one report of 10 at one point, 10 Ukrainian soldiers. So I think, you know, like we said before, like the threshold for war is going to be very high. It's going to take a lot more than, you know, the occasional border skirmish and buildup, I think, to get a full-blown war.
Yeah, but I mean, the counter to that is in 2014, let's see, on the Russian side, 5,600 people died, and on the Ukrainian side, 4,400. So, yes, the Himalayan conflict was that, but the most similar past, you know, reference case for what's happening right now, you know, did end up with thousands of deaths on both sides. Wikipedia is saying that in total, including civilians, you're looking at 13,000 killed. That's a non-trivial.
Yeah, I just number. Wouldn't use pre-COVID conflict as a good sort of inclusion in a base rate, just because I think, you know, between the sanctions that the U.S. just put on Russia, COVID, the fact that a war would probably lead to, you know, delayed exports, which is going to hurt their top line as well. I just feel like economically it wouldn't make sense now, whereas back then maybe things are a bit more frothy, you know, maybe a little bit less worried about cost. Yeah, I don't know. So that's why I was looking at 2020 as opposed to, you know, a bit further back.
How do you see sort of, Ross, this, what's happening right now? Like, how similar do you think we can consider 2014?
This was a point I was going to make earlier. Obviously, I think the Euromaidan revolution in Ukraine came as a shock, perhaps, to Russia. It was I personally look at 2014 in the field of geopolitics as a sort of paradigm shift. I think I've got the word bang on there, as a paradigm shift. It's obviously the largest annexation, shall we say, of land since the Second World War. And it was just, I don't think Russia ever thought Ukraine would necessarily come out of its sphere of influence in that sort of abrupt way it did. And you sort of have to look at Belarus as a comparison, what happened in Belarus last year. Obviously, I think this time round, Russia was ready for that, and they could see that coming. And even in Russia itself, with Navalny, like, it's the similar sort of protest, isn't it? It's the sort of pro-Western, maybe not pro-Western, but sort of more liberal. I don't know how to put it, because I don't think Navalny's even a liberal. So, but it's all relative. Side. Yeah. So, I think.
So you think like 2014 was.
It was different in that it was a surprise.
And that Russia necessarily wouldn't be inclined to do it again, because it got a much harsher response than they were expecting within Ukraine, which is what they were, you know, which is what they didn't want.
I think Crimea was the big thing, and the main sort of thing that's come out of it. And Russia, I don't think if Crimea didn't have Sevastopol, which is obviously a massive Russian naval base, it's sort of the way that Russia projects power into the Black Sea and then obviously into the Eastern Mediterranean and the Western Mediterranean down into the Red Sea. You've got the Port Sudan base just opened up as well. Crimea is instrumental in that. That's why Putin moved in. It was purely out of strategic need. It wasn't out of this sort of nationalist way, like sort of, it wasn't an ethnic thing, if you get what I mean. Obviously, Crimea's majority ethnic Russian, just about. I don't think that was the sort of justification for it, supposedly. And the referendum they had sort of was written to legitimize it or made to legitimize it. But yeah, so it was purely strategic need moving into Crimea. And this time round, trying to link it back to this time round, there's what strategic need? What would Russia get out of taking more territory from Ukraine this time round? Just more trouble, really, would it not? That's probably another reason why I'd say that there's not going to be a war. And if there is going to be a war, it'll be localized within the separatist regions, and it will just be, it's another leverage point for Russia to leverage against Kiev and Washington.
Are there any other sort of points on in the Donbas area that is geostrategically important that there would be value in getting it, or is that really just Crimea and they sort of got that in 2014? So why bother alienating Ukraine further and facing sanctions?
And what I would say, in terms of land, there's not really anything. But what I would say is, I think Ukraine has cut off water to Crimea. I think they've blocked off like quite a vital canal into Crimea for fresh water. And some people are speculating that Russia might do something to perhaps try and open that back up. And maybe that is the sort of the reasoning behind this, is that they want Ukraine to come to the negotiating table and maybe, I don't know, put that water back on the table, which obviously secures Crimea even more. Or maybe they want Ukraine to recognize Crimea as part of Russia. I don't know.
That might or is there like a, in those regions, a sort of population that would, if integrated into Russia, would therefore boost Putin's domestic popularity like he had the last time?
That's a good point.
It was both strategic, but then also I think there was that political aspect too, where Putin was willing to take the risk to gain a geostrategic thing, in part because his popularity was down, which it is again now. And so if there's a boost to popularity, he could find
Putin's
there.
I really worried about his
I agree with
about his popular, like about his approval ratings as much as like Zelensky would. Like Zelensky just got into power in 2019, I think.
But he's
a bit of an upset.
But getting the support of the people is crucial in regimes such as Putin.
To some extent. Like I feel like 60% is enough to then just, you know, be able to use a hard fist, but
that's 60% that you're getting reported out of Russia. You're therefore taking the poll necessarily at its face value. Right. If last time 60% was enough to push Putin to annex Crimea, then why is it being discounted now? Right. Putin does care about popular support. Otherwise, why would he jail dissidents? Why would he, you know, stop protests? Maintaining popular support in authoritarian regimes, whether or not there's a democratic facade, is important.
Locking people up doesn't garner approval. It's just like, I think there's a difference between having a focus on maintaining power.
It's a short-term hurt to your. Yeah, but maintaining power is in some way related to support.
I think
support can give you power, but you don't need support for power. Is my point.
Trying to butt in a bit here, but I think the main thing for Putin is keeping Russia together. Like in the 90s, I was saying about Chechnya earlier. Like if people were the thought at the time, you read some of the sort of literature around it, like the journal articles and stuff. I did an essay on it. If Chechnya became independent, then what's to stop Circassia, the sort of the neighboring state, historical state of which has its own ethnic group and Dagestan having their is another
like a domino effect.
Yeah, it was the dominoes, the Chechen dominoes, what my next video is called. And you've got different ethnic groups in Russia. Russia's such a diverse country, and like you need someone. I think Putin's just wants to keep it all together. I think that's why he's done the constitutional restructuring as well, is so that he can step down and sort of in the future. I think he's going to step down maybe in the next 5 years and sort of go into the background, not necessarily fade away straight away, but
obviously. Didn't he extend it though to like 2030?
Yeah, he's extended it. He's extended it.
Because wasn't it before it was 2026? Like, why would he extend it if he wasn't going to?
I think it's so he can come back if he needs to. This is what my lecturer sort of said. She floated it as a theory, but I kind of thought it's got some weight to it. You look at transitions of power in Russia, it's never been peaceful, really, has it? Look at the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Russian Civil War. There's never, and then even some of the transitions of power within the Soviet Union, like the purges and de-Stalinization and stuff. I think that's very much on Putin's mind. Like, he doesn't want to step down and have Russia descend into chaos. I think he'll sort of semi-step down and then sort of groom the predecessor up to standard so that he can step down and that there won't be any turmoil within Russia. I mean, I could be completely wrong here, but that's my take on it.
Yeah, I mean, if he steps down, he would almost certainly, yeah, someone in the comment section just typed that silverback. Yeah, when he was prime minister, he was still calling the shots. That's back when the term limits, you couldn't have them be continually sequential. So Putin went from president to prime minister and then back to president. And even while he was prime minister, still calling the shots. It is interesting, like, will he step down? I don't see if him extending it, why he... That's almost telegraphing that in advance he plans to stay on. Otherwise, he might want to do this sort of like later on, especially because he just got another extension quite recently.
Yeah. Someone said, tell me you know nothing about Russian politics without telling me. That's very much my... I don't know much about the domestic politics, but we can speculate a bit. I guess it's good entertainment. But yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
Sorry, carry on.
Well, I was just going to ask, like, do we have some questions in the TikTok section that we can, like, that we can get to? I feel like we've been talking for a little bit.
Well, before we get to TikTok questions, people in the chat can start thinking of questions. I think it would just be, like, what would we be watching for if we were going to expect conflict to actually break out in Donbas? If we're, for instance, like, we're particularly interested in whether or not fighting will break out to the extent that 250 Ukrainian military deaths will take place. What sort of things do you think we should be like looking out for if that possibility were to come true?
I'll let Andrew go first on that one. But
yeah, you know, I'm trying to think, because, you know, my position, I think, you know, we all share this somewhat, is that we don't necessarily think that violence is going to reach that level. So I'm trying to think of, you know, what could you know, potentially result in that sort of magnitude of deaths. I think you know, something we were talking about before is, you know, maybe some form of cyber warfare would be a sign that Russia is serious about conflict with Ukraine. So maybe you know, keeping an eye out for any moves like that might signal that things are heating up a bit. I think you know, I don't know much about Zelensky, like, as a leader. He's only been in power for a couple of years now. So I think, you know, the track record is small, but I think if he were to do something, you know, extremely bold, whether it's actually go on the offensive more than just build up on the border, you know, watching what he's saying and doing, I think will be important as well. But honestly, I don't think there's a ton that could lead to that level of violence. Like, I don't think Ukraine really wants to go to war with Russia also.
But I mean,
I was going to add to that. I think Zelensky, he won election very much as part of his election campaign was finishing the war in the East. I think, and I think Ukraine perhaps was setting up to sort of take those territories back before this happened. Perhaps they were I mean, I've been looking at, obviously, you guys know about Nagorno-Karabakh and the role that, Turkey played in that as well. And you got to think Turkey is just across the Black Sea from Ukraine, and Turkey still hasn't recognized, though Turkey works with Russia in many fields, they haven't recognized the Crimea being part of Russia yet. I think they're very opposed to it.
They've even made a statement recently, like reaffirming that they don't acknowledge Crimea.
Yeah, absolutely. And just linking that in with, this is what I was going to say as well, is linking it to Nagorno-Karabakh, like how that sort of stalemate that's resulted, this sort of new stalemate that's come along benefited both Russia and Turkey. I very much thought it benefited Turkey at first, but you think Russia's now got peacekeepers within Nagorno-Karabakh as well. I can't remember, I've gone off on a tangent here, but yeah, the role of drones, I think, in Nagorno-Karabakh, when I was looking at doing my video on Ukraine, I was thinking maybe of, I think there was, I looked at sort of maybe Ukraine, I'm trying to say is Ukraine was maybe looking at importing Turkish drone technology, and look at how that successful that was for Azerbaijan against Armenia. And maybe that would have played a role in a Nagorno-Karabakh war, and linking it to what we were going to say again about whether the 250 death thing. I think if Ukraine started an offensive against the separatists to sort of crush the separatist resistance, and whether that involved Turkish drones or whatever, I think that would be the biggest. If Ukraine started to try and take that leverage point away from Russia by taking back the territory, that's when we could see some bigger movement, I think. Maybe if they got the separatist controlled areas, if they took Donetsk and a couple of the more major towns in Luhansk or the northern sort of separatist region, I think that's when we could see things get a bit dangerous. But again, I don't think that will happen. I think now that Russia's sort of built all these troops up on the border, that is to sort of deter the Ukrainians from doing that, from going into the Donetsk People's Republic, so-called. I don't know if that made sense, but yeah.
No, it does. I'm sure it's also tricky because Ukraine, from what I understand, sort of the inside of Ukraine, you know, the people there very much identify as Ukrainian, but on the outside where it's, you know, bordering Russia, there's a lot of Ukrainians that sort of identify as, you know, one sort of ethnic block with a lot of the Russians. And so yeah. When you don't have that just inherent tension there, I feel like, you know, it's harder to result in violence.
You look at the history of the region, a lot of that region was populated by Turkic peoples, I think. Sort of, have you heard of the Crimean Tatars as a group?
I have not. No. Sounds
familiar. Have we talked about it in a video before?
I'm not sure, maybe, but basically that region has always been, Crimea, Azov, has always been a battleground between Turkey and Russia. A lot of Turkic people live there. And I think maybe as a result of the wars, many of them sort of moved or passed away, and the area was settled by Russian-speaking people. I think, and then a lot more Russian people were brought in during the sort of Stalin years to work in the industrial sector within mines and things like that. So that's part of the reason why a lot of the Russian speaking people live there. I'm not entirely sure that's accurate. I'll probably get ripped in the TikTok comments, but yeah.
No, listen, that's happened. I think they did the same thing in Germany with a lot of Turkish like migrant workers coming over to Turkey coming over to Germany to work. And then a lot of them end up staying there and intermarrying with the people in Germany. And that's why, you know, you have a lot of, you know, half Turkish, half German people.
One thing I think is interesting, though, is in 2014, the Russian total force buildup on the border at the start of March was 30 to 40,000 troops. And how many did you say have now been amassed at the that have been amassed?
80,000. 80,000?
Yeah. 80,000. Yes, which it seems to me that if the opportunity were to present where pro-Russian separatists in the region were to start conflict, that then that could sort of easily escalate in a similar way of 2014, at least to the point where you clear a couple hundred deaths on the Ukrainian side. I mean, right, 2014 ended up being on the Ukrainian side 4,000, 5,000 deaths. And, you know, that was a big deal at the time, but I think from the collective memory, at least outside of it, kind of faded back. So you could see how that could, on much smaller scale, happen and then still sort of hit the threshold that, you know, we were originally concerned about, whether or not that then expands out into a war that happened in 2014 is, I think, an entirely different question. But it seems like a lot of the same factors that 2014 happened are also happening here. And I wonder if, you know, maybe that's sort of overemphasizing the similar factors and ignoring the other ones. But on the other hand, maybe it's also just we don't want to admit the likelihood that, you know, some sort of fighting is going to break out in the region if a lot of the same factors before 2014, you know, are holding right now. Like, I just don't necessarily see why this is so different, with the exception of, Andrew, what you brought up being COVID and economic recovery. And so sanctions are even worse right now. But maybe that's...
Could you read... Sorry, go ahead.
No, go.
Well, like, I was just going to ask, when you talked about this doubling of troops from 2014 to, you know, this year at the border, you know, Russian troops, could you read that as, like, a lesson learned by Russia? And when, you know, they only came with 30 or 40,000, conflict was more likely because the stakes seem lower. But if they come with 80,000, you know, it's more of a, like, a deterrence play. You know, like, we don't want conflict, so here's what we have.
But going up to someone else's borders and saying we have 20,000 troops is less likely for conflict to break out. No, it's more likely for conflict to break out than if they brought 80,000 troops, right? Like, once you start reading recent force parity between the two sides, wouldn't it make it more likely that conflict broke out? For instance, in 2014, the Ukrainian armed forces 232,000. 80,000 is therefore getting a lot closer to matching Ukrainian military might, which would make conflict seem more likely rather. Like, why, if conflict broke out when there was a huge discrepancy, when that discrepancy gets smaller, why would the risk of conflict go down?
Ross, do we know what the Ukrainian military count is at the border right now? I know you said 80,000 Russian troops.
I think it might be 100,000 Russian. Oh, sorry, you say Ukrainian troops?
No, Russian.
Ukrainian. I think.
Well, Ukraine would just bring in the military. I mean, if it were to happen, right? The Ukrainian buildup is less important than the Russian buildup.
I would say that it's of equal importance, to be fair, because,
like, if Ukraine's coming with 20,000 troops to the border and Russia comes with 80,000, then I feel like, you know, it's not likely to result in any real conflict, but. I think you're right. The closer you are to parity, the higher chance you have of conflict. So,
Miss Blue Whiplash is saying, are we really at DEFCON 3? I mean, I think that's probably too extreme, right? We're saying, will 250 deaths occur on the Ukrainian side? That's, I think, far. I mean, that's like on that probably is like DEFCON 3 in terms of the region. If you're Ukrainian, your DEFCON scale is different than sort of how I'm analyzing DEFCON as an American.
I just love this whole situation. You know, just we're all, you know, political science people, and this just feels like sort of this classic case of like asymmetric information on both sides of the situation, not knowing what people's intentions are, having to assume intention from their actions. It's just fascinating stuff to see play out.
I think, I agree with that. I just read 80,000 Russian troops still, I think is the level. But I'd love to know the Ukrainian, what percentage of the Ukrainian military is in that sort of vicinity of the separatist areas as well. Mm-hmm. As you say, asymmetric, we don't hear anything about the Ukrainian side, do we? It's all in the West in particular, it's all about Russia and what Russia's doing. I think it would be good.
You would think
to know.
Their military is also mostly positioned in that region rather than on their western border.
Yeah.
I'm rough with my maps.
I'd love to get some intelligence on that. That'll be interesting. I'd love to know exactly where all the troops are and everything, but obviously we won't never get that sort of information, I guess. But
any chance that Ukraine could lose more territory? I mean, yeah, great question. And that's sort of part of what we're looking at. I would say that if territory gets taken, then the 250 deaths question then all is along the way for that. So I think it's less than whatever that number is. I don't necessarily know how we think about that. For instance, on the website Metaculus, there's been 84 predictions on whether or not by October 1st, 2021, that there will be 250 Ukrainian military deaths in the Donbas region. And they give that a 43% likelihood of occurring. How do you guys feel about that, based on the conversation that we've had?
Yeah, I mean, Ross, I don't know if you have thoughts, but I think that it's going to be very much up to Ukraine. You know, I think Russia, at least, again, this is just my perspective, I feel like they would prefer sort of a status quo. You know, we didn't see tensions flare up for a while in the interim between maybe like 2015, 2016, in like the past 6 months. And so I think, you know, if it were up to them, it wouldn't escalate further. But I think if they feel that they need to take more territory in order to get stability in the region, they'll feel comfortable doing that, as we've seen in the past.
Sorry, on the Russian side, taking more.
But that then assumes that, right, like how much in 2014 was this also a charge that Russia enabled versus Russia caused? Meaning like, we're thinking about this being from the Russian perspective, but what about from the pro-separatist perspective? Because if they were to start something, given these conditions, then I think there's a decent chance that Putin then would support it, maybe begrudgingly, but still do it. And so I think there's three actors really at place right now: Russia, Ukraine, and the separatists that are in the region, because they can also start the conditions for war, which is what happened in 2014 as well, at least by the timeline.
Could set up war?
I mean, yeah. I mean, it's the same way that, like, you know, large companies in the colonial era started much of colonization was sort of driven by not actually the governments, but by companies, in the same way that the separatists could be the ones that start the civil war. I mean, that happens quite a lot, where a state's hand is being forced by the actions of someone else.
I thought you were just going to say like Al-Qaeda and going to Afghanistan, but that also is a apt analog.
Yeah, that too.
I can't see the separatists making any gains, to be honest with you, unless the Russians majorly funded and armed them or
reinforced them. Syria.
Yeah, I just don't think it will happen.
Didn't they do that though in 2014? Also, fund and support the separatists.
I think they're just there is the extent to which Russia supports them is so blurred and unknown. Depending on who you speak to, obviously, if you look in the Western media, it is Russia itself. It's Putin himself on the ground fighting. Whereas if you look in Russia Today, Russia had nothing to do with it. Like, it's somewhere in the middle, isn't it? As always.
Yeah, because I can definitely. I mean, what, it came out yesterday, this morning, that bounty, that Russia putting the bounties on U.S. troops, that intelligence was actually, they had like low to medium confidence, which is therefore in intelligence speak, meaning it's probably not necessarily like that. That wasn't actually something that they could at least prove. So, yeah, it really is difficult, just depending on who you're reading, your entire interpretation.
Well, obviously, like you said, the U.S. domestic political stuff comes into the way that the media portrays stuff, what administration they want in there. And I think many, probably a lot of the big media companies in the U.S., at least in my opinion, very much in bed with the sort of corporations in America as well, and what's good for business. I don't know how to explain it. Obviously, they want a president or a Congress that is beholden to their interests, and yeah, it's all sort of speculative, blurry. But yeah, and then that's the prism of most of the of Western media is sort of corporate interests. I don't know if that's if you guys agree with that, but I don't know. That's the very much the paradigm that things get portrayed in the media, and obviously that isn't always the case. Like you say, with the drone strikes and the is it the bounties on U.S. troops
with the Taliban, yeah, in Afghanistan.
Why would they report that if it didn't have some sort of political domestic political significance? If you know what I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think arguments be made that that's the case. I think the other one is that it gets clicks, and the media is really not about the facts. I mean, the facts are the delivery vehicle in terms of how they get sort of clicks and engagements. That's how they brand themselves. But I think sort of the counter to interest and control is that they just want money and clicks.
I think you're right. Well, I just think a lot of this with Trump, especially, like Trump basically was he held up the US media, did he not? Because he caused so much stir and outrage all the time that they just got so much money from it. It was probably the best thing that ever happened for the media, was he not? Like
big time. SNL did not have to write any comedy for years because exactly. Every Saturday it was just a new Trump story.
Yeah, I think you're right there, Clay. I think it was just clicks and money, I guess. But yeah.
Well, clicks, money, and then I think, you know, politics is then what comes sort of next, almost.
Yeah.
Right. Especially now. I mean, that's been just a trend where people, the newscasters' political views are not private, but instead a public thing. That's a different conversation for another time.
Yeah. We'll move away from that one.
I was about to say, keep away from the stone. In the UK, Piers Morgan, you know, recently that came to.
I think Piers Morgan just wanted a reason to quit.
He is done anyway.
I mean, he's had bigger outrages on that show anyway.
Yeah. Geopolitics, guys.
Well, I mean, there is the geopolitics of Piers Morgan when we kicked him out of the U.S. because you guys sent him over and he then was on CNN for a dreadful length of time. And then you guys had to take him back, which we appreciate.
He is a walking clickbait, is he not? He's just... Yeah. He just gets whatever he does, whatever will get the most outrage or stir up the most interest, I guess.
Was he on like game shows at all, like America's Got Talent, or is that science?
I think he was on Britain's Got Talent. Yeah.
Yeah, which
I don't know. I don't follow him that much, to be honest with you. Yeah. I try and stay away from that, obviously, with my channel. So
do y'all think that Russia gets any support? You know, obviously. There are countries that seem to be coming to the aid of Ukraine and that have, you know, sort of echoed their calls for Russian troop withdrawal. But do you think that there's any states you can think of that would be supporting Russia in their efforts to maintain a grasp on Ukraine?
A good question.
Yeah. I mean, does Russia need it when it comes to this, right? Especially if they're trying to assert themselves at least as a regional hegemon in the area. They might not necessarily care about it. You could see like maybe China with regards to circumventing sanctions and sort of trying to promote, you know, de-dollaring the world, perhaps. I think at least as of right now, I wouldn't at least see any sort of like major actors come up on the Russian side. Ross, I don't know about you.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think. Like you say, China. Don't want to say the C word too much for my. I think. I don't know if they're that interested, really. I mean, they're more interested in economics, are they not? The Belt and Road. I don't know if Ukraine's part of the BRI or not. I'm not sure.
I don't think. Actually, that's a good question. I'm not sure. I don't think I remember it being sort of a key pathway for the Belt and Road, but it might be.
Yeah, I don't think they're that interested. The C word.
They do you think like an Iran might come?
That's uninteresting.
Or at least be vocal in support of Russia, given the fact that they've also sort of undergone debilitating economic sanctions on behalf of the US.
Again, I think it's a partnership of convenience, Russia, Iran, very much so. I mean, they're historical rivals, big historical rivals. Turkey, Russia, historical rivals, Russia, China, historical rivals, Russia, Iran, historical rivals. It's all partnerships of convenience.
Because they all are enemies of the US.
Yeah, Russia's true allies in a geostrategic, very raw geopolitical sense are actually probably the UK and Germany. But obviously, we're on different sides of this. If you were to look at a system of alliances in, or France as well, like the Russians were allied with France in the First World War.
And the second,
yeah. So
the little Entente.
Yeah, and obviously France left NATO at one point under de Gaulle, I think. So there's that dynamic. But yeah, I don't think trying to bring it back to any countries that support Russia. No, don't think so. Belarus, but what are they going to do? No offense to any Belarusians out there. Or
see, and I think that's probably part of. I'm trying to think of this from like the Russian perspective. I feel like that may also be part of sort of the impetus behind their actions, is that they're sort of alone geopolitically speaking. Like, as you said, they are relationships of convenience, but in terms of like sort of true allies or partnerships, they don't have many. And so, you know, the potential of losing even more influence right on your doorstep is probably a pretty scary eventuality for Russia, especially as you said, if Putin does plan to step down in the next, let's say, decade even, you want to leave Russia in a good place, geopolitically speaking, not, you know, losing influence even more than it already has.
Yeah. You got to look at the dynamic within Russia as well. You've got like the Eurasianists and the sort of, I can't remember the term for it, but the Europeanists. Like, I think Putin was very much of the Europeanist sort of mindset. He thought Russia was a European country. It was very much tied to Europe. And then obviously 2014 happened, and now he's sort of looking to Asia as well. So that plays into it quite a bit. I don't know. I think Russia's interests lie in Europe. I think in the long, long, long term, Russia's future is Europe. I think Russia Russia and Europe needs to fix what's happening at the moment. I think Russia, there's the conflict of values between Russia and Europe. Like, Europe's very liberal, Russia's very conservative.
The US can make it work with the South and the North. I think Europe can make it work, you know.
And historically, right? Like, Russia was considered part of the West. It was only after the October Revolution where you sort of have the splintering of Russia off from Europe. I mean, they kind of were always like the redheaded stepchild, but Russia liked to consider themselves part of the West, and a lot of the empires at least tolerated Russia at the table, especially in the 1800s. So the question is, can that happen, right? I think Gorbachev was the most recent opportunity that they had, and then it got bundled for, you know, a large number of reasons, including the old Bolsheviks really kind of held on to power. They just ditched communism as their vehicle of maintaining power. Is this the century where Russia rejoins Europe, or do they fall into China's orbit for now, and then that sort of pushes them away even longer until whatever conflict between China and the US, and then wherever Europe decides that they want to be within what seems to be a coming, at least cold, conflict.
Yeah.
And there may be the other option, right, of like the world island, like we've talked about, this idea that, you know, China, Russia, even Western Europe, you know, they're all landlocked, or like they're all, you know, connected, contiguous is the word I was looking for. And so, you know, there are a lot of sort of cost synergies, you know, trading synergies that could come about as a result of just working together, you know, across both continents.
Now, someone in the I think this is actually a good time to transition to some listener questions in the chat. And someone asked, what do we think specifically about the U.S. sanctions? I'll be honest, I haven't read a ton about the sanctions.
About the U.S. sanctions on Russia?
Yeah. I've read that economists say that it won't have a major issue right now. I think the main one was about selling rubles for debt. Someone want to correct me or jump in who knows more about it?
So from my understanding, at least this debt piece that you're talking about, part of the sanctions are that U.S. banks are not allowed to buy Russian debt. And so for those who don't know, countries just like companies and they need money for infrastructure projects or healthcare, whatever it might be, they can issue bonds and people can buy the bonds and they'll get interest payments on a recurring basis. And then at the end of it, they'll get their balloon payment back that they initially paid for the bond as well. And so basically, I don't think that U.S. banks were a huge buyer of Russian bonds to begin with. But I mean that the U.S. is a big market. It's a big, wallet that now will not be, buying those bonds. And so I think the idea is, as Clay said, it's not a super debilitating hit to Russia's economy at the start, but it's one of those sort of things that you put in place that, over time you can sort of tighten the grip a little bit and sort of increase the effect it's going to have on Russia's economy if Russia continues to make the U.S. upset. I think that's Biden said that it was proportionate. I think that's pretty accurate. I don't think it's, out of line. In fact, honestly, because these were in response for the 2016 election hacks, I believe. And so I would expect even maybe a bit more severe sanctions coming out of the U.S. But also, I'm sure we all have thoughts on sanctions in general. I don't know if they're the most effective means of punishing countries to begin with.
Ross, how about you and the sanctions?
I don't know much about sanctions. I don't know. I look more at geostrategy with my videos and I don't know about sanctions. I don't think it's going to cause any major economic shift. I think Russia after 2014, the sanctions in 2014 have obviously pushed Russia eastward towards China. They've made the country more insular. I think Russian farmers have vastly benefited from the sanctions put on Russia because they've had to turn to their domestic market, food and stuff. And it's actually not had the effects necessarily that the US and many European countries necessarily wanted. Russia, I think, I don't know. It's not been good for the Russian economy, but it has been good in certain sectors, I'd say. Mm-hmm. And then obviously thinking about the sanctions now, I don't know. I think it's all symbolic, really. It's very much saber rattling, as someone put in the comments earlier.
I think at least historically, when it comes to economically blocking out Russia, no significant economic sort of outage has ever occurred for more than a few years. Between the October Revolution, for instance, and the start of World War II, there were a lot of times where, the U.S. and all these companies would sort of pull out of Russia because they did insert really bad geopolitical thing or human rights thing. And then 6 months, a year later, a year and a half later, we're all like, oh, is Russia now good and we can work with them? And so I think, if these sanctions aren't effective, is what they're saying, it means they're probably somewhat effective, especially because actually the economist that was saying that is linked to a research institute in Moscow. But will it make a huge difference? Historically, with the case of Russia, it hasn't. So I don't see why it would be the case. And if this is what Biden's proportionate response is with regards to the 2016 election interference, I don't know if he understands what proportional necessarily means.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it begs the question, what do you do with a power like Russia, who seems to, as you said, sort of shirk any of the economic sanctions that you try and put on them, at least in the view of the U.S., is still taking steps, aggressive steps to, annex the territory around them, have control of them, at least. What else can you do besides continue to put on sanctions, try to have talks in the interim and cross your fingers?
You could, depends how far you want to go. I mean, well, you could do the same sort of disinformation that Russia does elsewhere within Russia. You could prevent U.S. companies from, you know, following Russian government orders on with regards to app requirements on phones or web restrictions. You could do more. It's just the issue that larger economic costs, just given Russia, will then have economic costs on the people that are instituting the punishment. And the question is, do politicians have the appetite, and therefore also the politicians, you know, constituents have the appetite for that? And probably not.
One thing I would say, if you wanted to hurt Russia economically, just do what they did, I think, in March 2020 with the oil price slump. That was pretty scary for Russia, I think. Their government budget is, I think it's largely based on oil revenue. So,
which is part of why Ukraine's so important, is because that's the big way that they export their oil.
Yeah. But if you do that, you'd annoy the Saudis and everyone else in the Gulf, and they're not the people you want to annoy because they've got a lot of money. So, and yeah, they fund a lot of, I think there's a lot of money, Middle Eastern money in US politics as well. Probably has something to do with it. I don't know.
Big time.
And now we have a question from Paul Cullen, who says, is the North Sea route a game changer? Ross, we know we talked about this on your first podcast appearance with Global Guessing, and you have a video on this. What's your take on the importance of the North Sea route?
I don't know. For the moment, I think it's only ice-free for half the year, so I don't know what the efficacy of it will be. And obviously, it depends on how quickly ice melts and at what rate, and whether the Arctic becomes ice-free year-round or the majority of the year. So it all comes down to that, really, I guess. But obviously, China's looking at that. Sorry, TikTok. And then Russia is looking at that as well. They're sort of looking to develop the northern part of the country. I don't know if it will be a game changer. I couldn't really tell you at the moment, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
If the ice melt happens, and they can and global shipping can use it as an alternative route. Look at the Suez Canal at them. Just what just happened down there. Then yeah, it could be a game changer. Could be.
Do you think the US and other countries aren't sort of thinking creatively enough about, if it were to become a useful passage, just how valuable it is, and therefore like not spending the resources? Like, it seemed right, if the passage therefore becomes useful, it seems very valuable given the reduction in shipping times. And so it seems, if you're a country that has the resources to expend, why not, you know, do some actions there in case the 15-20% chance that it actually becomes useful? Do you think sort of other countries are, you know, missing an opportunity by not considering the what if?
Well, obviously China's considering the what if of their Silk Road. Polar Silk Road plan. But the US, what has the US done in regards to the Arctic? I haven't done much. The Canadians are sort of a bit worried, I think, but the US has largely not focused on it. And they've obviously got Alaska. You guys have got Alaska up there, pretty cold. I don't know what they've done. I don't think there's a couple of US military bases in Alaska, I'm pretty sure. Whereas I said before, I did a map of it, and the Russians have by far got the most military bases in the Arctic Circle. So it's very much going to become an Arctic, a Russian ocean at this rate. I think the Russian geographers wanted to rename it the Russian Ocean at one point, or they were sort of lobbying for that. So that could become the case.
Wow. Woke Brother Benjamin saying Greenland purchase making a bit more sense. Yes, that's what... I think we said that in the last episode when we talked about this this topic.
Yeah, he was in for the long game, Trump was.
Who would have thought?
Yep.
Who would have not thought he was the best forecaster out of all of us, you know? He saw this coming.
Yep. I don't know what else to say about Northern Sea Route. That is about it. the Suez Canal thing has sort of brought more attention to it.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, having an alternative trade route rather than relying on just one. I mean, not one, but you know,
it is really
reducing the chokeholds that you know are possible. Always makes sense.
Just in popular culture, I don't think people realized like just how much of trade happens, you know, on ships. You know, I think people tend to think of like ships going across long distances as somewhat anachronistic and like you know, very old school, but mm-hmm. that's a huge part of how the world works, you know.
Well, because so the ocean's huge.
Yeah, it's massive.
Which maybe. I know is like a not like an insightful comment, but like
yeah,
it's huge. No, you're not wrong. It is, yeah, it's really big.
More comments? Questions, war or not war, someone posted. I think based on our conversation, we're leaning less than 50% for, I mean, conflict, maybe around 50%, a little bit lower, and then war being probably at least half of whatever that number is. So if conflict is maybe 40%, war 10, 15, which might even be too high in of itself. What are you guys thinking? Yeah,
I'd say 10%, maybe less for war between Ukraine and Russia.
And then conflict? I
mean, is there a time frame for this? Are we saying end of 2021? The same.
Let's say end of 2021. Yeah.
Yeah. It'd probably be in a similar camp, maybe like 15%.
For war.
Maybe 10% for war. Maybe like, you know, 20... low 20s percent for just much larger conflict.
Really interesting, because I mean it also depends on how you sort of define war.
Yeah.
I think it's either 1,000 or 10,000 battle deaths is how it's conventionally done, which I know is a huge difference between those two numbers. if it's 1,000, it's probably higher, and if it's 10,000, then lower.
Yeah.
So a good question. Do you think Catalonia will get independence? Throw that curveball in there. What do you guys think?
I'm so That's ignorant on this issue.
I mean, when did the Catalonia protests happen? Was that 2017?
I think so. 2018, 2017, 2018? Maybe.
Let's see.
I think the Catalonian leaders are in Finland or somewhere like that, aren't they not? And
yeah, they had to leave. Yeah, I mean, listen, there's so many cases like this. Like Kurdistan is a similar issue where you have this autonomous region that people want independence. I don't know. I mean, I think so. There's a community in Spain called the Basque people, and they're like, I think they have their own autonomous region. They have a soccer team that you know that's in that region that only like all the players are Basque and nothing else. And you know, they seem to be. I mean, maybe I'm mistaken, and they've also sort of had a bunch of protests recently, but they seem to be able to exist, you know, and have, I guess, discrete rights and able to live within Spain and not be their own country. So I feel like maybe the Catalans will go the way of the Basque and have a similar arrangement without having their own country. But I don't know, maybe you know more than me, Ross. Maybe there's stuff ready in the works.
I would broaden it out to Brexit and look at Northern Ireland, Scotland as well. If there's movement in Northern Ireland and Scotland, not maybe towards independence or United Ireland, then Catalonia is more on the table, definitely. But I don't know. I think that would be. I don't think there's any chance of it at the moment, considering how much the Spanish government clamped down.
Yeah, that was kind of ugly. Yeah.
Yeah, very. It didn't get reported that much, I don't think. Within Europe particularly, I didn't see much on the mainstream. I was on there a few times, but I don't know.
What's interesting is this question was on the prediction website Metaculus, and in 2018, September 30th, 2018, they said there was a 13% likelihood that Catalonia would become an independent state by October 1st, 2022.
That still seems, you know, maybe ballpark. Maybe that's a reflection that not much has happened since those protests.
Well, the question's also the
sustained
closed.
Protests, and it's closed. But yeah, that sounds right.
Any other questions from the chat? Fire away.
Or suggestions for what, you know, if we're able to do this again, other topics that you want
to talk about. Ooh, Ross, someone asked you, why are you British?
That is a seriously good question. I don't know.
Maybe the best one of the day.
I guess I could say I was blessed and I was cursed with it.
Very diplomatic.
I don't know. Did he not hashtag out the asterisk out the British in it? Maybe he's not very... I don't know. I can't find it. Yeah, there you go.
But
yeah,
has Scottish exit settled down? Ross, what do you... you're the closest to it, quite literally.
I think it's off... I don't know. There's a lot of internal strife at the moment, by the look of it, within the SNP in regards to Nicola Sturgeon, who's the leader. I think she was in a bit of hot water before, but I think she's been cleared. But there's still some people that think that that clearing is not legitimate. I think there was allegations against the old leader, Alex Salmond. And then he, it was sexual misconduct allegations, I think. And then he's obviously started his own independence party now. And he's gone off and made his own one. So how that will impact, I don't know. But I don't think he's only running in certain elections that won't impact the Scottish National Party majorly. So I think, I don't know. It's, I don't know about this, how that will impact independence. But they keep pushing for an independence referendum. They keep pushing for it. And it's actually kind of from... I don't know, this is probably a very skewed view on it, but it's with COVID going on and they're pushing on for an independence referendum in this, with obviously the intention should be on coronavirus. So I think people might be a bit annoyed about that in Scotland. Maybe I don't speak for the Scottish people. I think they would probably hate for me to speak for them, being an Englishman. But yeah.
Yeah, what's interesting about that is, once again, going back to the site Metaculus, because it's just an interesting way to see what a large number of people think about an issue. They say there's a 57% likelihood that if Scotland has a referendum, that they'll vote to leave, but only a 18% chance that they'll leave before 2025, which I think, and actually there's a big drop in their forecast when COVID sort of comes out. And so I think, yeah, that's just, it's not top of mind right now. Yeah. And so if it were to come up to a vote, I think 60-40 is about fair, about how it would sort of pan out, with 60% being leaving the UK. But I just...
The complete reverse, right, of what it was in 2014.
It was like 55, 45. It was a little bit closer than that.
I thought it was like 60% to stay.
What I would say is that I think it's laid the ground. This whole pandemic.
55. Yeah, it's 55.3, 44.7. What were you saying, Ross? Sorry.
Yeah, I would just say it's laid the groundwork for independence, because all of the sort of responses have been at a national level. So you've had the Welsh government, the Scottish government, and the Northern Irish government all had a different response to the British government. And maybe that's sort of moving the power poles towards those devolved governments. I don't know. Whether there's a swing back the other way, they can say, well, look what we did during coronavirus, obviously, if they had a good response, and then compare it to what Westminster did. But I don't know what how to compare that at the moment. We'd have to get the whole thing behind us, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know what the sort of Scotland death rate versus the English death rate was, adjusting for all the sort of characteristics differences between the two. And I think the other factor that comes with that is the UK is ending COVID very strong, at least as of right, ending COVID as of today. Don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but as of right now, things are going really well, and people tend to remember the last part of things or the first part the best. And the first part, you know, the UK had less restrictive lockdowns than the rest of Europe, and the last part, they vaccinated way better than all of Europe. And those will be sort of the two things that, you know, might stay in people's minds, and so that could also change things. We have another question. How serious is this Ukraine issue? By Sam W.
Depends on who you ask.
Yeah, I mean, I think as of right now, you know, it's not an issue insofar as like conflict is broken out. But if you were to look at, you know, where things could go poorly with regards to you know, global stability, or if you're looking for like geopolitical outbreaks, this is something that you should probably be watching until at least this current troop buildup sort of resolves. At least that's my take. Ross, cool. Andrew?
I mean, very much in agreement. You know, I don't think this is going to be a huge humanitarian crisis or anything that's going to be, you know, or even very protracted. You know, I could see this sort of flaring up, you know, over the next few weeks, and there being a lot of questions about what's going to happen. But then, you know, by early summer, this was just another instance of tensions flaring up.
Let's do three more questions. Ross, why don't you take this one? And we have talked about this, but why is Russia so aggressive towards Ukraine? Coming from Soderberg 11.
I don't know if I think it's, you say aggressive, it's more out of a defensive thing. As I say, with the strategic depth that Russia wants, and Ukraine's part of that. Obviously, Russia had control of everything from practically Hamburg to the Ural Mountains in Europe before 1991, and now Russia has, if Ukraine were to join NATO or at least allow troops on their territory, that would put NATO troops or foreign troops within a few hundred miles of Moscow, a few hundred kilometers. So I think that is what the reason why they don't want Ukraine making any moves westward. That's what I'd say. And that's why they act the way they do towards Ukraine. That's my answer for that one.
Next question is Syria with a question mark. Justice 1997, you're going to have to be a little bit more specific than a country and a question mark.
Is that an answer maybe to the question about Russian aggression? Like, is Syria the answer, or is that a separate question?
Well, we'll have to wait for Justice to respond.
So one is, will Ukraine join NATO? You guys want to take that one?
I mean, we talked about this a bit earlier. I think Ukraine would love to join NATO. My guess is, you know, Ross's theory about this sort of frozen war preventing these countries from joining some of these other multilateral organizations is going to bear fruit. And Russia will end up joining. I also think, you know, NATO, Russia or Ukraine is not on, you know, the top of the priority list for NATO. So, I mean, I don't see it happening anytime soon. Could it happen? Certainly. And if it does, I mean, that's a really bad sign for Russia, because now, you know, you could have U.S. Military bases right at your doorstep, which would be pretty scary. So, I mean, I think that's all going to depend on how the relationship between Russia and Ukraine progresses. But yeah, not in the near future.
Yeah, I'm not even entirely sure the mechanism for joining NATO. I assume that there's some sort of documented process that you have to go through. And I wonder if just is NATO what most countries will be focusing on right now, or will it be some sort of Asian, East Asian version of NATO, right? Like, is the US more sort of focusing on the Quad over, you know, NATO, and just the sort of the shift to Asia, the pivot to Asia. I just don't know how that'll impact Ukraine joining NATO. I think if you were to live in like a magical land where like everything that people wanted to do, you could do, that Ukraine would join NATO. I just don't know if in the list of priorities that it makes it and that it happens anytime soon.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. Also, I don't know about, you know, some of the past missions that NATO's done, but I don't know if Ukraine has participated. I doubt it, you know, on any of those missions. I know even like Northern Macedonia had, I think, joined two of them before they entered into NATO last year. So I think, there are also some prerequisites that Ukraine might not have met yet to join.
Yeah, NATO. Territorial integrity being the main one there.
Yep, exactly.
That last question, we can't really play that one.
So it was the perfect ending question. What if we abbreviate what they're talking about?
Yeah, go for it. Go on.
Okay. So the last question coming from Woke Brother Benjamin is, do you guys feel...
Hello from Portugal. Or hello to Portugal, by the way.
Yeah, hello from Portugal. Do you got there we go. Do you guys think NATO countries will make more and larger military exercise moving forward, further forward? Ross?
Maybe. I think there might be a response to the Russian buildup, maybe. I think the best place if I was a NATO strategist would be maybe Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania. Look at putting some exercises there. That would probably ruffle some feathers in Moscow, definitely. So, or maybe Poland would be a bit more of a safer option, a bit further away. I was up under Trump. Obviously, the Germans fell out with the US a tiny bit, and Poland sort of took on the role as the new Germany of NATO, I guess. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. But I don't know what that will be under Biden, because obviously Biden probably... we'll get on more with Germany, but exercises, I don't know if they'll be larger, but it would make sense to hold some sort of readiness exercise, I guess,
especially because I'm pretty sure Russia was holding exercises as well in the Black Sea as the US was was on its way. And so just doing exercise in the same body of water that an adversary is in is a bit dicey as well. So I could definitely see, I agree, exercises coming.
Right.
All right. Well, everyone, that was the Global Guessing Weekly Podcast, Episode 9. If you guys are joining us in the TikTok stream right now, you guys can find the full video of this podcast tomorrow. If you look Global Guessing up on YouTube, or go to our website, globalguessing.com, and you will see the article tomorrow.
Do you want to plug your stuff? Yep. I'm sure they know it already because they're on your TikTok, but for those watching on YouTube.
First thing I'll say is I'll put a link on TikTok on my link tree to you guys, to the video of this. Yeah. I'll share it on the community tab in YouTube as well, so they can go over to your channel and watch. Thanks for watching, guys. That's all I say. I love seeing people active in the comments, following, saying, a lot of people saying good videos. So
yeah, thank you, Woke Brother Benjamin, for the good questions.
Yeah, thanks, guys. It's been good. It's good to have an interactive element to it as well with other people. So, yeah,
that's all I'll say. If you have more topics, please also send them to any one of us, so we can keep doing this.
And let's do a little post-stream chat, but this will be the end of the video. So this was Global Guessing Weekly Podcast, Episode 9, with Ross from AR Global Security. Thanks, everyone.
Cheers, guys.